Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I hope you don't mind, listeners, but this episode is best enjoyed with the head. I'm your host, Essence of Wetness, Lady P, no relation to Master P. Joining me today is author, historian, and tall, cool glass of film noir knowledge, Professor James Naramore. Welcome back to the show, Jim.
Thank you, Pauline. Yeah, glad to be here.
All right. Listeners will recall that Jim has previously joined us for other shadowy episodes, such as Mulholland Drive, Psycho, and Night of the Hunter. But today's show features perhaps the darkest film yet, Roman Polanski's 1974 thriller, Chinatown. Are we still giving credit to Polanski? I'm inclined to give more credit to Faye Dunaway myself, but I don't know. What do you think? Polanski, Dunaway. We'll figure out how to best distribute credit for the tone, structure, and performances, and we'll also discuss the film's enduring legacy. Chinatown landed in the 78th spot on the Sight and Sound Critics Poll. Listen up to find out if that position still holds water. All right, Jim, shall we go for a swim?
Sure, it's going to be difficult in this Chinatown climate, but yeah.
So true. It is so true. It should be noted, Jim and I are now recording this from the Midwest and could probably use some of that California sunshine, but we'll do our best to pretend. Roman Polanski's 1974 film Chinatown is at once a loving reimagining of a popular classic Hollywood genre, while also being among the most caustic and cynical movies ever made. The film takes place within the familiar noir milieu of sun-baked 1930s Los Angeles. It stars Jack Nicholson as P.I. Jake Gittes. I was so worried about saying Gitz. I'm so glad I got it right. a former police officer turned private detective who makes a living peeping in on secret affairs and illicit rendezvous, usually at the behest of a jealous spouse or partner. Apparently, Los Angeles in the 1930s was teeming with possessive husbands and beleaguered housewives because Jake is able to employ a couple of former colleagues and keep the lights on at his small business. He makes a point of staying out of trouble and avoiding entanglements with law enforcement. That is until a woman calling herself Evelyn Mulray walks through his door. Initially, Jake thinks nothing of Mrs. Mulray's request to find evidence that her husband Hollis is having an affair. Jake notes immediately that Hollis Mulray is a figure of some repute in L.A. He's the chief engineer of the Department of Water and Power. However, cheating husbands are Jake's bread and butter, and he's not going to let Hollis's stature within the community get in the way of his crack in the case. Jake's initial stakeout doesn't yield much. Hollis appears to be preoccupied with business matters, town halls, meetings, visits to reservoirs, and a couple of curious trips to the beach where he lingers all night long. One of Jake's associates also notes that Hollis was in a very public argument with an older man, but Jake dismisses the fight as extraneous to the case. Eventually, Jake and company find what they're looking for when they spot Hollis dallying around town with a young blonde girl. Jake photographs the scene and calls it a day. Soon after, Jake's snapshot of Hollis and the girl find their way to the tabloids. The story of the chief engineer's love nest makes Jake the talk of the town, or at least the talk of his local barbershop. However, the notoriety brings with it a few unanticipated snafus. Namely, Jake soon learns that the woman he met claiming to be Evelyn Mulray was an imposter, when the actual Evelyn, played by Faye Dunaway, shows up at Jake's office and threatens to sue. To make matters worse, Hollis Mulray is then found drowned in a reservoir. As Jake watches the police dredge up Hollis's body, all pretense of staying out of the way of the law falls by the wayside. The police are claiming Hollis committed suicide, but Jake thinks there's something fishy, if you will, about the whole thing. He begins his own investigation, teaming up with the real Evelyn Mulray to find out what really happened to Hollis and what's behind those mysterious late-night sleepovers at the shoreline. Before long, Jake finds himself in over his head, drowning in a sea of greed and malfeasance. As with most film noirs, the plot of Chinatown meanders, winding its way through the various darkened corners of the cityscape. Polanski and screenwriter Robert Towne tease out every plot thread and slowly weave it back together, revealing a sick tapestry of lies and political apathy. The story culminates in one of the bleakest, most nihilistic endings in the history of cinema. If I mentioned it's bleak, I keep saying that. It isn't the crimes, which are admittedly heinous, or even the criminals that make the film so despairing, but the knowledge that justice will never be served and that the powerful forces in the world will continue in their evil doings, unfettered by law enforcement or a sense of moral consciousness. But is this Darkness at Noon type tale a little too dark for 21st century eyes? We shall discuss. All right, Jim. So, do you like Chinatown?
Yeah, I wouldn't be here talking to you. Yeah.
That, believe it or not, there are people who don't like this movie.
Really?
Which is shocking to me. They're wrong, obviously.
On what grounds? I don't understand.
I don't understand it either. Some people are just not, don't take to it. I don't know. I can understand watching it and feeling so kind of like a deep sense of revulsion that might turn some people off.
Well, you know, I guess I don't feel the film is as bleak as you make it sound. I mean, obviously, it has a very despairing ending. Creepy ending. It was originally in Robert Towne's script. Jake and Evelyn were supposed to be able to get away, run away to Mexico at the end.
Right.
And it was Polanski, I think, who determined the ending we have. But I think, how to explain this? I don't think the film loses its social consciousness. I don't believe that one comes away from it saying it's simply a cynical film. I think it's a critique not only of what happened in Los Angeles in the 1930s and wound up determining power relations in that city for long, long afterward, but I think it's also a sign of the temper of the times in 1974 when the film was made. This was almost the end of the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War is still going on. And the Watergate scandal took place at the time the film came out. So the mood in the country was not so much cynical, but I guess you could say in some ways like the mood of the country for some people today.
Sure.
So I think the film is in a way a kind of a metaphor for what was going on in America at the time.
Yeah, maybe we can step through that a little bit, right? So 1974, the thing that comes to mind for me is Watergate.
Right. Actually, the Watergate, I think that the Watergate scandal hadn't really broken when they were filming the film.
Okay. But good when timing the film came, of the release then.
Yeah, no kidding. And that, you know, it's almost where they, since the movie is so much about water, were they trying to remind you of Watergate? But
sure.
No, I don't think they were. Yeah, yeah.
That's a funny coincidence. Yeah,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So as I was sitting down to rewatch this movie, I will say honestly that I was not in the mood to watch it at the time. I was just feeling like, I don't know, that I'd seen it before and I wasn't so
right.
eager to revisit it.
And sure, sure.
I sat down and I was transfixed again. It was amazing.
Yeah,
I
it's an engrossing film, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. There's been a lot of material in the news lately, obviously a lot of sort of comparisons between the Nixon administration and our current administration.
Yes.
And just maybe I'm interpreting this film, maybe the bleakness is coming from my own psyche rather than the film, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a great scene when Jake Gittes asks Noah Cross, the character played by John Huston, how much money do you need?
Mm-hmm.
And the only answer is, the future, son.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's still, you know, same as
yeah.
it ever was, I
yeah.
guess, you know?
Yeah.
I'm feeling very, yeah, this film could not have come at a more appropriate time for me, or this recording could not have come at a more mm-hmm. appropriate time for me. There have certainly been, I don't know, I can imagine watching this movie and feeling like this is excessively bleak. At least the ending is excessively bleak. Like it, it's,
gee, I don't
it's
know.
Really dark,
I like the ending.
Yeah.
When I first saw the movie, when it was first released, the ending just stunned me. I just thought, wow, this is not like a Hollywood movie. This is good.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw this and just the emptiness, that just like emptiness in the pit of your stomach feeling at the end. It was kind of profound. And I think this film has remained in my top 10 ever since.
Really?
I love this movie. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's partially why I was so worried about rewatching it, because I thought, maybe you won't like it as much. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just given everything with Polanski, I'm kind of hesitant to give him that sort of place of esteem in my in my mind. Mm-hmm. But there's something about this that's so undeniable. But we'll come back to Polanski. For now, we'll stick to the movie. Were you able to rewatch the film for the show?
I didn't need to, actually. I was in the process of writing about it when we got ready to do this broadcast. Yeah, I'm writing about it for another project, which I can talk about later if you want.
Oh, sure, yeah. That's again, a stunning coincidence. Since you are the film noir expert, I feel like we should take advantage of your expertise. And let's talk about how the city is portrayed in the film. It's sort of a cliche at this point to talk about, you know, Los Angeles is a character in the movie, but to some extent, it is very much.
And that's what's good about it. I mean, I think the great writer about Los Angeles was Raymond Chandler. This film maybe has more in common with Dashiell Hammett than Raymond Chandler, but I think they're both sort of lurking in the background here. But it has to be about Los Angeles, because the story is about an actual, you know, political corruption in 1930s Los Angeles, something that's very basic to the history of the city. So yeah, and the production designer of the film is Richard Silbert, who I think is very good. And who knows? I wasn't living in Los Angeles in the 1930s, but it just feels right. And you're seeing not only the downtown, but certain environs of the city, certain things that to me just sort of resonate Los Angeles.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, there's a history of using specific Los Angeles locales in film noir and how it's kind of playing.
Right. Well, I don't know if you've seen Tom Anderson's great movie, Los Angeles Plays Itself. Have you ever seen that?
I've never seen that, but
oh my gosh,
should. I know.
That. You got to see that. Yeah.
I know.
You know, he is, you know, a great historian of Los Angeles himself. And the movie's entirely a set of film clips about how settings in Los Angeles have been used in movies. He's a critic of the way Hollywood has portrayed Los Angeles. And I could go on and on about this, but one of the film noirs that he likes is Kiss Me Deadly. And the reason he likes it is because if a car goes down a street and turns left, and the next shot shows it driving down, and that's right. That's true. I mean, in other words, whereas movies in general are, you know, Kuleshov said this back in the 20s, they're capable of creating an artificial geography. So space that you see on the screen doesn't necessarily conform to the space in the city. Anyway, and he's very good about criticizing certain film noirs for showing gangsters living in modernist mansions in Los Angeles, whereas in fact the history of the modernist mansions are often progressive or left-wing. But anyway, yeah.
Sure, yeah. So I need to see this. I know it was on Netflix for a little while, and I missed it, and I'm still kicking myself for not
I love this guy, but he's got his prejudices. He doesn't like Point Blank. He doesn't like Point Blank.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, but he doesn't like San Francisco. So anyway,
that's fair. Yes, Point Blank, John Borman.
Yeah.
that's totally fair. I can see that. That's funny. Anyway, but I guess what I should have sort of given the rundown of what Chinatown is in the movie, right? What does Chinatown represent?
Well, just at the literally at the level of the plot, Jake Gittes, used to be a cop working in Chinatown. Mm-hmm. He knew that there was something corrupt there. He didn't like it. Something bad happened in the past involved a woman. And when he gets involved in this case as a private eye, another woman is involved. And it's a little like Vertigo in the sense that this guy voyeuristically is observing a woman, and she becomes an echo of a woman in the past. And it turns out that in trying to help her, his guilt becomes magnified, and but Chinatown, okay, it figures in a couple of ways. All through the movie, there are references to China, very nice little motif at the edge of the film, a dirty joke that Jake tells at the beginning about how Chinamen have sex. There's when he goes to the Mulray place, there's a Chinese gardener. And anyway, there are these little references to the Chinese. And the film ends in Chinatown, where Jake had been in the past. And that's where the awful thing happens at the end of the movie. And of course, the great last line of the movie is, "Forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown."
Jake, yes.
Yeah. meaning that, you know, from the point of view of the guy who says this, the cop who says this, it's a ghetto, you know. It's where all these awful people live. But in fact, Chinatown is a symptom of this almost awesome greed and evil that really belongs in the rich areas of the town, but really covers the whole town and is spread out now into the valley around Los Angeles. So Chinatown is kind of an ironic, what would you call it? I don't know. That Chinatown isn't an evil place.
Right.
It's brilliant use to, I think, by Town, because there was a certain kind of Orientalism in the earliest hard-boiled detective stories. If you read the early Dashiell Hammett stories, which are set in San Francisco, there are a lot of Chinatown stories there. Mm. And there's a bit of this Orientalist motif running through Chandler. You can see it in The Big Sleep and other places. So using the Chinatown, it evokes the memories of old Hollywood noir, but it's being used in a very different way, not in a racist way. Yeah.
Right. Anyway. Exactly. Yeah. Uh-huh. Right. Throughout this story, we get this. Jake is constantly saying, you know, I don't want to nail you. I don't want to get my goal is not to catch the little fish, but the big fish. Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so Chinatown, you can catch the petty criminals, right? And you
right,
can
right.
You can do your best to kind of arrest. You can, you know, it's kind of, well, I wish I had like crime statistics for 1930s Chinatown at the moment.
Yeah,
but,
weren't that bad. But you know, there's this whole myth about the Tong Wars that used to take place and stuff like that. Anyway, I don't know whether in L.A., but in San Francisco.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, the idea that the systemic corruption can ever be quelched, or that there's anything that anyone can do about that, I think that's sort of what we're getting at, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like smaller individuals can be punished, but ultimately the system remains the same, and those in power so it's a bit of an allegory, this idea of Chinatown as something separate from this story that's sort of haunting Jake, that doesn't have that much to do with the actual plot mechanics of the film.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
One of my favorite moments in the movie is when Evelyn tells Jake where, I believe his name is Hong, lives, her butler.
Right.
It's Alameda. And everyone who is familiar with L.A. knows Alameda, that's Chinatown, right? But they never say he lives in Chinatown.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I thought that was perfect. Mm-hmm. But, it's this sort of Chinatown, this specter.
Yeah. Well, it's also, it's a brilliant use of that the stereotype of the Chinese in hard-boiled fiction, because that kind of Orientalism it operates on is, you know, the notion that the Orientals are mysterious, enigmatic.
Right.
They, you know... but the real mystery isn't in Chinatown.
Right.
It's in this movie. No.
Right.
Chinatown is, people in Chinatown are victims and not not the cause of evil. Anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. So in your book on film noir, More Than Night, you classify Chinatown as a nostalgia or retro film.
Yeah, I got some new thoughts about that, yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. Well, so go on then.
All right, sure. Let me back up a little bit. What's inspired me to rethink about this is a really good book by Richard Dyer about pastiche. It's called Pastiche. Mm. I don't know if you or your listeners know what pastiche is. It's a very old term in art. It starts back, I think, in 16th century Italy, and it's taken from an Italian word, pasticcio, which means a mixed dish, and it was used by painters in that period to describe paintings that were a mixture of styles, imitating a mixture of styles by other previous artists. And then by the 19th century in England, the word pastiche means any kind of an art that is knowingly imitating a previous model. Not forgery, but, you know, a pastiche. Mm-hmm. Frederick Jameson, when he's writing about postmodernism, says that pastiche becomes really big in 1970s and 80s America, and he sees that as a symptom of late capitalism in various ways. But he's certainly, he doesn't like pastiche. He calls it blank parody. He says it doesn't have any value connected to it. It's just nostalgia.
I see.
And to some extent, that's true of some of these pastiche films. Dyer, who writes wonderfully about these films, he uses the term neo-noir to describe them. And I've always shied away from that term. I tried to avoid using it when I was writing my book. But I like this limited, very limited way that that Dyer uses it. What he's referring to are pastiche films about film noir. It's one of the major things that the pastiche films begin to do. They start like with Body Heat, mm-hmm. and let's say the Coen Brothers movie Miller's Crossing. Mm-hmm. You could even say that Brian De Palma's sort of hyper Hitchcock movies are I don't know if you'd call them pastiche noir. They're certainly pastiche Hitchcock. So anyway, a lot of these movies come out. And I think that's a good way of describing these. And Chinatown belongs in that group of movies. One of the reasons, by the way, that they Hollywood becomes so interested in noir in that period, I think, is because the French have made it very interesting. Truffaut's Shoot the Piano Player and Godard's Breathless are pastiche films. Mm. But they're very different from the Hollywood pastiche films. Shoot the Piano Player, for example, is full of references to film noir. But sort of B-movie noir or lesser-known examples of noir, it has a very broad frame of reference. There are a lot of allusions to things that are not film noir in it. Furthermore, Shoot the Piano Player sort of lurches from one kind of movie to another. Sometimes it's like a film noir, sometimes it's like a comedy, sometimes it's, you know, it just goes this way and that way. And Breathless is the same way. But Body Heat, as a representative of this trend that happens in Hollywood in the 70s, it's more like a conventional movie. It isn't bounding from one thing to another. And its frame of reference is fairly narrow. Body Heat's major point of reference is Double Indemnity, which was a major Hollywood production. Most of the people in the audience would know about that film. Body Heat is, you could say, a conservative film. It's really maintaining conventions of Hollywood under a liberalized new system. It's a color film, but it's trying to imitate the palette of the original film noirs, the black and white film noirs. And it has a selective memory about what film noir was, and it helps to construct our memory about film noir, which is often inaccurate. For example, one of the things that Dyer points out is the music score in Body Heat, which is a mixture of a kind of languorous saxophone along with strings. And he says that is the quintessential sound of film noir, even though, Dyer says, nobody in the 1940s ever used that kind of music. Okay?
Yeah.
So what happens with these neo-noirs is they evoke a memory, but the memory is very selective and often inaccurate, if you see what I mean.
Sure, yeah.
Chinatown is often grouped among these films, but I think Chinatown is different, and it's one of several pastiche films, I think you could say, or films that make some use of pastiche. that are more interesting uses of pastiche. I think a real problematic one is Robert Altman's The Long Goodbye, mm-hmm. which is all really using, I think, more parody than pastiche. Mm-hmm. Another use of pastiche that I think is really effective is the David Lynch films, like Lost Highway, yeah. Just full of noir references. Sure. But what makes him different is he's not following the patterns of standard Hollywood narrative. He's giving you a surrealist film, a dream film that uses these references.
Right, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So Chinatown. Now, Chinatown uses pastiche. The film opens with the old 1930s Paramount logo, black and white, and it closes with the 1970s color logo. The theme music, which is by Jerry Goldsmith, it's a wonderful theme. It's a solo jazz trumpet with strings, okay? Not saxophone and strings, but jazz and string. Okay, once again, it's quintessential noir music, but it was never heard in this music was never heard in any yeah. previous noir film. And this is a Panavision film shot in color, and it tries very skillfully to evoke some kind of memory of the original films. The color pattern is sometimes monochromatic. The framing is tight and restricted, like the old Hollywood things. In various ways, it's obviously nodding, making allusions. It's casting John Huston as the villain, and of course, John Huston is an icon of the Maltese Falcon and film noir. Okay, so it's got those things, but this is not just a nostalgia trip. And even though it's an engrossing traditional kind of Hollywood movie, you know, with a clear narrative, a beginning, middle, and end, and cause-effect and all that sort of thing, as we were saying before, I think the movie could be understood as much as a period film, as a pastiche film, and it's using that period in a very interesting way, in a critical way, and it's looking at society in a critical way, and in a way, it's there was already in film noir a kind of one branch of film noir anyway, a kind of a latent left wing tendency, a critical tendency. To show the dark side of American society, this really fulfills that tendency. I think this film does. So it's both a pastiche and a period film, and a very effective use of the old formulas of film noir, I think.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so I guess in my mind, the distinction we're making here is kind of the film. There are certain pastiche films that function as more of an exercise in recreating a certain style,
right?
An atmosphere, and there yeah. are other films like Chinatown that are trying, and I think successful in sort of building off of these
yes,
genre
yes,
tropes to tell
yes.
a new story.
Yeah,
right?
yeah.
And I think we touched on this in the Mulholland Drive episode as well. Like it is kind of borrowing from
yeah,
very
all kind
familiar
of stuff.
Techniques,
yeah.
right?
In fact,
yeah.
you could almost say I think that Mulholland Drive is more pasticcio than pastiche, meaning it's like the Truffaut model I was using in that it's not just film noir that it's pastiching. There are several other kind of genres or frames that are going on in the thing. It's Hollywood in some way.
Sure, yeah. It's a gangster and
yeah,
all
yeah.
kinds of
whatever.
Things.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of why Chinatown is so successful for me. I guess I really like your assessment of it, that it's more of a period piece than a neo-noir, right? It
yeah,
just so
yeah,
happens
yeah,
to be...
Yeah.
It happens to have a lot of the rhythms of a film noir, right?
Right,
the sort of plot that keeps unfolding
yeah,
faster
yeah,
than the audience
yeah,
can take it all
yeah,
up.
Yeah.
But at its heart, it's telling a new story.
Well, not an it's like the old noir with the gloves off in a way. I don't know.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
yeah.
yeah, it's with the gloves off. I like that. It's not going to. It doesn't baby its audience, you know.
And by the way, it plays with the audience's knowledge of film noir in an interesting way because the Faye Dunaway character, Evelyn Mulray, when she comes into the movie, just because of all the conventions of this kind of private eye genre, you expect her to be a femme fatale of some
right.
kind. You know, there's something something enigmatic and strange about her. And she's beautiful. But it turns out, no, she's a victim.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's so interesting. We are initially very mistrustful.
Yeah, you're put in Jake's position, and so you're suspicious of her. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Well, let's talk about the performances. And I think Faye Dunaway's as good a place to start as any.
I gather you're a big fan of hers. You keep talking about her.
Yeah. I think she's fantastic, and I don't think she gets her due.
Uh-huh. Well, she won an Academy Award, didn't she?
She did. Not for this one, but for Network. But this was a tough year. I think this was the year of Jenna Rollins and Woman Under the Influence and Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, Ellen Burstyn. So,
well, it should have won the Academy Award anyway.
I think so. I think of those three performances, oh, God, that's tough. I mean, Jenna Rollins... She's also great, but to me, this Faye Dunaway as Evelyn Mulray is just stunning.
I think it's a very difficult performance because Evelyn is a very wounded and neurotic person, she has to convey that, and she does it wonderfully when she comes into the end of the film, but still be who would be a love partner for Jake.
Sure.
You know, yeah, and to be able to do both of those things when the audience doesn't know exactly what she's about, it's quite wonderful. Yeah,
right. Yeah, she has
and
to
it's one of those things when you discover what the big secret is, you look back on her earlier parts of the film and you say, oh, I can see the signs of the what all this is about. Yeah,
exactly. She has to be both. Sort of confident and deeply wounded, and she has to convey that at the same time. And as you say, neurotic, right? So, and she does a good job not overplaying the tics, right? Like there are some sort of visible manifestations of those neuroses, right? Like she does have things that she, like she knows she's flicking her hair out of her eyes and
sort of
wincing every once in a while, but she's also there are also instances where she's very poised, like in her introduction especially, right?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. When she comes in to do a lawsuit against Jake, when he actually goes out to her estate and meets with her, she's been riding a horse all day. Right. They sit down at a table to have a conversation with iced tea, and she's sweaty and she's even though she's been out riding a horse, there's something tense and nervous about her. She does that woo and still remains attractive and sort of interesting. So anyway, it's not your typical glamour girl performance.
I mean, I think about the breadth of her work and the variety of roles she's played, and I just think, like I said, I just think that she's done so much and she's capable of so much. And, you know, just starting in, obviously, Bonnie and Clyde and this Network, even Mommy Dearest.
There's a lot of films she's made that I'm not a fan of, but that doesn't mean I don't think she's talented. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I think that
she comes out of a kind of a method tradition.
Right, exactly.
And so that's why the neurotic stuff is always there with her, that kind of subtext of a psychological background.
Right.
Whereas Nicholson is more of a traditional movie actor. And he's good in the film too. Very good.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I love what he's doing here, and I mean he's not necessarily what comes to mind when I think of film noir detective character, right?
Now, the opening shot of him, you say, whoa, this is a new take on The Private Eye.
I think of Nicholson, you know, especially One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, something of a charming lout.
Well, he is the charming lout to a degree in this movie. Yeah,
absolutely.
He's a bit of a dandy. Jake Gittes is.
Yeah.
But he overdresses, and he's very proud of the accoutrements in his office: the Venetian blinds, he has not a liquor in the bottom drawer of the desk, but he has a liquor cabinet.
Right.
He has a China coffee set. He's always immaculately dressed.
Absolutely, that white suit.
And, yeah. But at the same time, he's a hothead. He's a bit of a vulgarian. He can't. When he first meets the real Evelyn Mulray, he's telling a dirty joke, and he can't usually have a conversation with a rich client without lapsing into profanity. And so he has a lot of rough edges. And what's nice about the script or the characterization of the character is that this guy that you at first you think is just an operator really is concealing a real sense of justice, of compassion behind all that exterior.
Right. It's funny, again, with the disintegration of the production code, we can now have characters like Jake Gittes,
Well, if people are smart enough to write them anyway. Yeah.
Sure, true. But it's funny because we have the kind of stoic, cynical anti-hero of, you know, Humphrey Bogart or
Robert
Ryan.
It's very much the kind of character that Bogart played, in the sense that Bogart was a sort of a tough, stoic guy, but he had this sense of justice and so forth, at least in some of his movies. Bogart played a villain almost as often as he played a good guy. But
sure.
Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But what I love about Nicholson's performance is just that he makes you believe, like, there's something about Nicholson that feels like an anachronism in the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, but he makes you believe it, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think there are a couple of things about him. One is that, I don't know how I would describe it, that patented Jack Nicholson grin he's got. That
sure.
It's sort of a, what is it? Is it lascivious? Is it insolent?
Possibly, yeah.
I don't know. But he uses that very well in the film. And he's an actor in some ways without vanity. You know, he's got a bald spot, but he doesn't mind showing it to you.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, and yeah, absolutely perfect. And but one character who I wouldn't describe as an anachronism. In fact, he fits right in. John Huston.
You mentioned
him earlier. Noah Cross.
Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and assume all of our listeners have seen Chinatown
at
this point.
Well, you have to. I guess we've already given away too much now.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know,
but
yeah, Huston is the villain in the film, and a very creepy one. Yeah.
Yes, extremely.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, you kind of talked about how.
Well, he's the representative of it's beautiful casting because he's the representative of that thing in the past, and I always thought that in a limited way, Huston is a very good actor. He never really tried to act very much.
Absolutely, yeah.
But
we'll hopefully get a chance to see the other side of the wind.
Yeah. We'll see how he runs. It's being edited out there right now.
We'll see.
Yeah, it's going to be on Netflix is going to show it.
Right. I am eagerly awaiting its release.
Well, anyway, but he has what is it about Huston? There's some kind of an aura he has. Maybe he brings it with him because of his reputation, but it's also he's this big guy with this kind of courtly drawl, and he just seems a mixture of something charming yet sinister. I don't know.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
He doesn't do any kind of winking at the camera.
Noah Cross.
I am John Huston playing someone.
Yeah, no. You forget about it's John Huston. You start thinking about Noah Cross. Yeah.
Right. He's so good. Could you imagine approaching John Huston? If you're Roman Polanski, imagine approaching John Huston, and you're going to be playing a pedophile.
Well, oh no, I'm sure. Yes, of course. There's a great irony in that, isn't it? Yes, Polanski is the elephant in the room.
Right.
Here.
Exactly. Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah.
Well, I guess while we're on the subject, Roman Polanski. How do you let's just talk about him as a filmmaker first of all, as kind of a art house filmmaker turned Hollywood director and
briefly a Hollywood director. Yeah.
Right. Not.
I
for,
mean the other
for,
the other yeah. really great Hollywood movie he made was Rosemary's Baby.
But yeah, I mean, it's how does his work? You know, we think of Knife in the Water and Repulsion.
Yeah.
And then, you know, how does that style translate to this kind of more what's meant to be sort of a more mainstream fare.
I think it adapts very well. I think his good Hollywood films are every bit as good as his art films, and in some ways better. He's one of those examples of, I think I mentioned this in the noir book. Here we're talking about a director who starts out in a communist country and winds up in Hollywood. And he has directed for what Godard used to call Maz Film Paramount and Nixon Paramount. And he makes that transition pretty well. And I think it's because, like Hitchcock, he was more interested in certain fascinating perversities than in politics that much. I mean, I don't see him. I think Chinatown is a political film by virtue of town.
Well, I guess we can give a little bit of a personal history of Roman Polanski in case listeners are unfamiliar.
I doubt if they are, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he, for you know, survived the Holocaust.
And of course the Manson murders are connected
Manson
to
murders,
him.
Right? Yeah, survived the Holocaust. Becomes a filmmaker in Europe. Moves to Hollywood. Marries Sharon Tate, and she and their unborn child are murdered by the Manson family, and then he makes Chinatown.
And then he becomes an accused child molester.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I mean, there's just so many different chapters of this story, and they're just all terrible.
Yeah.
Right. Convicted child.
Yeah. So tell me, Pauline, where are we going with all this?
Right. You know, well,
are you about to say we should not watch his movies, or
I don't know. I need guidance. I need guidance because I don't.
And I'm going to give it to you. No.
Are you? Yeah, I don't know. No. I'm hoping someone can. I don't know. I don't know what to do about this. I don't know where to put this because
interesting.
Well, for
so does it
like
mean
Woody
you don't like Chinatown anymore because you know Polanski's history?
I don't know. I was hoping that I would have that reaction, but I didn't. I really liked it. I really thought it was great. And it's easier for me to compartmentalize. I mean, maybe it's easier for me. I shouldn't say compartmentalize. Maybe it's easier for me to kind of to be turned off by someone like Woody Allen, who kind of incorporates some of these like all of his neuroses into his work. They're so clearly
about
him.
But you can say that Polanski trades on these things as well, or doesn't trade on them. Let's compare him to Noah Cross. I mean, it's weird that he himself, you know, imposes that ending on the film, and it is a very disturbing ending because it's a combination of pedophilia and incest. And by the way, that's the other thing that this is it's a film noir with the gloves off because it brings out the latent Freudian stuff that was in classic film noir. Polanski's not accused of incest. And Polanski is not a big capitalist who's manipulated the whole history of Los Angeles. But especially today in the environment we have patriarchal molestation becoming part of everybody's consciousness, Chinatown is relevant, I don't know. I would hate to see us start judging art by the character of the people who made it. Mm-hmm. If you do that, there's a hell of a lot of art you're going to have to stop.
Very true.
For me, anyway, sometimes the politics of an artist get in the way or cause me to disapprove of the artist. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they don't. I don't know how to explain this. Ezra Pound, was a fascist. Mm-hmm. But some of his poetry, I think, is terrific. Mm-hmm. Celine was a fascist. And, you know, I don't know. Yeats was pretty damned right wing too. But on the other hand, D.H. Lawrence, I don't know. I've never been able to warm to D.H. Lawrence, another fascist. So I don't know. Sometimes the stuff intrudes too much. I feel like you have to not be too puritanical about art And in some way, I think whatever it is that is creepy about Polanski gets into the films, but to the film's benefit in some ways. He's just a very good filmmaker.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess what's really troubling about the incident with Polanski is that it speaks to his attitude towards women, right?
Yes.
And young women.
Yes. Yes. And yes. And maybe I'm not sensitive enough about that, but yeah. But yes, undeniably. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then is that, that then reflected that, in his work?
Yeah. Yeah. But does that mean then that we shouldn't? I'm able to at least put that on hold when I'm watching Chinatown. But I don't know if everyone is able to.
Right. Yeah. And it is. I take it on a case by case basis. I don't know that I will go see his newer work.
Yeah, he has a new film, you know.
Oh, what's he got going on?
He and Olivier Assayas just made a film. Mm. Assayas was the screenwriter. And I can't remember now what it's called, but I think it was at Cannes last year. I'm not sure. Anyway.
Right, yeah. I mean, I guess the what's disturbing to me more than anything are just like my own justifications for why I continue to watch Chinatown. Think of all the monstrous things that happened to him in his life. And of course, he's so deeply cynical and wounded. And I can overlook this one thing so that I can watch this movie.
I think, like you say, you have to go on a case by case basis. I mean, I think Polanski has made a number of really bad films or not good films. But I don't think the badness of the film has to do with whatever his problems are.
Sure. Yeah.
Anyway,
but I won't make similar allowances for other people. You know, I can't enjoy Woody Allen movies anymore. Really, I mean, maybe I can. I can watch everything up until when the scandal.
Well, I was never a huge fan of Woody Allen. Okay. So it's not. There are some of his films I really like, but it's harder for me to. Because as my judgment of Woody Allen as an artist is not the same as my judgment of Polanski as an artist. I think Polanski is a more important movie director.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I guess I would like to think that we do hold artists to account for their behavior. I don't think being a brilliant artist should give folks leeway to treat other people as if they aren't fellow people, right?
Well, I'm sure that a lot of really good artists were total jerks. I mean, I'm sure John Ford was, but I'm not a big fan of Ford anyway. But I'm a qualified fan. This is a very interesting thing and kind of thing worth talking about. You know, if you just got rid of the auteur theory and stopped talking about who did
it. That's absolutely true. And that's kind of one thing that I did want to to talk about was just that who actually gets credit for these movies, right? And something like this where so much of the power does lie in the screenplay and the performances.
Yeah, well, and also the producer Robert Evans, who was also a jerk, I guess. But
oh boy.
Yeah. But I think the evidence is there for Polanski in the film. I mean, I can see his style. I can see things he did. It was his decision to shoot so much of the film subjectively.
Yeah.
And it's just so beautifully played and paced. And I don't know. It's the director's hand is there. Maybe if you didn't know it was Roman Polanski, I don't think you'd worry about it.
Yeah. No, it's true. Yeah. But I like the idea of sort of focusing less on the auteur theory. And while Polanski is undoubtedly the driving force behind much of the film.
I don't think I think for me he gets chief credit for why it's such a good film. Town, you know, there was a sequel to Chinatown called To Two Jakes, and you've got virtually everybody who was involved in Chinatown except Polanski, and The Two Jakes is an awful movie.
Right. I mean, it was directed by Nicholson, right?
Yeah, I guess it was. Yeah.
Yeah. might be part
of
the problem.
Well, but I'm saying the director has a lot to say here.
That is true. Absolutely. Yeah. Very true. Man, I'm trying to figure out a way that I can justify watching this movie. Continue enjoying it.
Well, if you have that feeling, then you're not obliged to enjoy the movie. You can just say, "Well, I'm so upset about Polanski that I it spoils the movie for me." But I do think that if you take that attitude too strongly, then probably 90% of the art that's ever been made. I mean, it kind of turns you into a Stalinist in a way, doesn't it? I mean, you know. There are certain kinds of people who are capable of being artists and others not, and I don't know.
I mean, we're getting farther and farther away from the movie because I think it's an interesting conversation.
Yeah.
But I would like to perhaps it is unfair to judge an artist of a different era by the morality standards that we have today.
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's up for debate. But
I mean, what are the standards do you have?
I guess anyway, that's true. Yeah. I guess that's true. But just going forward, people who continue to make films, like, I do believe there should be an expectation that they not be, well, I would say don't molest anyone. That should be.
I think there are two different things going on my mind. For example, let's take Harvey Weinstein. I have a friend who says everybody gripes about him as a rapist. They don't say anything about how he butchered films. And I say, hey, the two issues are very different.
Yeah.
and so that's totally separate to me from his behavior as a human being. Yeah. And if he's that kind of a human being, I don't think he should be encouraged to have a career. You understand what I'm saying? Because he uses his power to manipulate other people. So anyway, that's not good.
Right. Exactly.
So I can put him on the blacklist, but that's separate from my judgment of whatever films he produces. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. I don't know. We can continue to wrestle with this. I'm sure there are. I believe Annie Hall is on the list, so we can pick that up. We can pick up this conversation. Then.
Okay. I don't know if I even want to go there.
That's fair. Yeah. That's fair. All right. Well, I'm sure listeners have their own take on this subject, and I'm happy to field other responses. Yeah. But just so we're back to the movie itself, do you think that people, I mean, this is purely speculative, but do you think that Polanski's reputation and will ultimately hurt Chinatown, or do you think that the film itself is strong enough to withstand whatever happens with the sort of public discourse surrounding Polanski?
I certainly hope it won't spoil the reputation of Chinatown. Chinatown is a brilliant movie. And again, we're going back to the same conversation. If you're in the mode of saying, I don't like that person who did this, that's different from saying whether the thing is good or bad. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's possible for bad people to make good art.
Yeah.
And so to me, that's if we get into a position where we say, oh, I know something bad about X, Y, or Z, this movie's no good because X, Y, or Z is in it or had something to do with it. I just don't follow that kind of logic. That's all.
Mm. Well, I do. My concern then is that the Polanski stuff will overshadow everything else about the movie, and I think that there's so much here that is worth revisiting, even if you've seen it before. I think it's worth rewatching.
Well, I'm really surprised, and I hope people won't do that kind of thing. Because Polanski, Rosemary's Baby is a wonderful movie. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I mean, we'll see. I don't know. So I guess I'm willing to, well, actually, Before I ask the final question, I do want to just quickly, what is your Chinatown project?
What I'm doing is, you know that Oxford series called The Very Short Introductions?
I think so.
Oh, you don't know them. Huh.
I think, well,
I bet if you go into the Madison bookstore, you can find a bunch
of
them. Or if there's a decent bookstore in Madison, I don't know.
Yeah.
Oxford University Press publishes these really tiny little books, small little books. They called like A Very Short Introduction.
Yes.
Okay. And there's, you know, like there's one on Hegel, there's one on Kant, all the major philosophers. There's one on teeth. they do the sciences. There was a really interesting article about them in the New Yorker, and a favorable one. The writer said, this is like what the Internet for Dummies for intellectuals. You know, I don't know. It's like, anyway, there's some really good books in the series, and so anyway, they asked me to do one on film noir, and there's a very strict word limit to them because they're very short. And I said, no, I can't say anything about that I haven't already said.
Yeah.
And they said, don't worry, that's the way everybody does. So that's what I'm doing. Kind of boiling down the argument of the noir book into a very short space.
Okay.
But in the process, I got a few little new twists, like the one I was just telling you about Chinatown. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Do you know when listeners should keep their eyes peeled for it?
I'm hoping that I can finish it in about another month or two.
Oh, wow.
And then I don't know how long it takes them to produce it. So
that's very exciting. Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
and the I don't know if you know, but the Charles Burnett book is out.
I didn't know that.
Oh, you didn't know that?
No. That's very exciting. When did that get published?
It's been out since October.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Late October, I think it came out. Yeah.
Okay. I will include a link on our website.
Yeah. I was out in Hollywood for that.
Oh, you know what? That was just when I moved here. I remember that. I remember feeling very disappointed that I wouldn't be out in L.A. for that talk. Yeah.
Yeah. Charles came there and a lot of the people who worked with him. It was a big, and just the day before the talk I gave, the Academy had given him an honorary Academy Award. So he's one of the honorees this year. So anyway, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But anyway, the book is out, and so that's it.
All right. And yes, I will absolutely include a link on our website. And we did do an episode where we talked about Charles Burnett, but maybe
right.
I think we need to do a whole separate episode on Killer of Sheep.
Well, if that's one of your, oh, yeah.
It made the list, yeah.
I think I listed To Sleep with Anger
I
did it. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. They're both great.
Yeah.
So, I think that'll be another excuse to revisit, and I think that'll be well worth it.
Uh-huh.
Okay, great. We'll plan on that. But first, before we wrap up this conversation, back to Chinatown. Chinatown made the 78th spot on the Sight and Sound Critics poll. Do you think it is worthy of that position?
Yes, you told me, I forget what it was, that it's tied with two other films.
Yeah, Beau Travail and Once Upon a Time in the West.
Yeah, I think it's better than either of those two films.
Okay.
And as for the number, that doesn't matter where you put it. Like, it's one of your top 10, right?
It's one of my top 10. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a masterpiece.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, there you have it. And that's the way we frame it. Flixwise, that is. Listeners, what do you think of Chinatown? Come let us know on our website, flixwise.com. And if you want to weigh into the Polanski discussion, by all means, come find us on Facebook at facebook.com/flixwise. And any and all cloche hat enthusiasts should follow me on Twitter. The handle is @flixwise. But before you do all of that, please, please go to iTunes, subscribe, rate us, and if you're feeling extra generous, leave us a nice comment. If you don't, then the big bad podcast networks win. And we can't have that, can we?
Forget it, Lady P. It's Apple Corp.
Ah, it's so good. I'm just going to leave it there. Until next time, Jim, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks. It's always fun. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, next time back in L.A., we'll meet.
If I ever get there again, I don't know.
Exactly. Yeah. One of these days. All right. In that case, until Los Angeles, shall we head off into the darkness?
Yep.
All right. Done.